All right. Welcome back. Our first order, or we're going to call this Education Policy Committee meeting to order. And members, welcome back. And our first order of business today is to approve the minutes from our last meeting on Wednesday, March 13th. Rep. Frazier.
So moved, Mr. Chair.
Wow.
I'm going to roll.
Great. You moved to adjourn?
Rep. Frazier has moved to approve the minutes from Wednesday, March 13th. Any discussion? Hearing none, all those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. Very good. We've approved the minutes. Before we begin with bill hearings, I want to outline how these next few days are going to unfold. Today, we're going to start by hearing the DE2 amendment, and nonpartisan staff will walk us through the provisions, and the bill author and staff will answer any clarifying questions that you may have. Following that, two additional bills will be heard here today. Tomorrow, we'll reconvene to hear public testimony and open the floor to members for a more detailed discussion. I also want to note that the deadline for submitting amendments is tomorrow at 7 p.m., so keep that in mind. On Thursday evening, we will conclude the rollout of the Education Policy Committee bill by marking up the DE2 amendment and any other submissions, including amendments to the amendment. Following those motions, the bill will be referred to the General Register, and we should be complete with our scheduled committee work. Do we have any questions on the process? Do my best to answer. Wonderful. With no questions, Chair Pryor, would you like to move House File 3782 before the committee?
So moved, Mr. Chair.
Now that the bill is before us, please move forward.
Thank you for the introduction. Thank you, members, for allowing me to present our bill. And I think the most efficient thing to do is at this point turn it over to nonpartisan Ms. Parra for a walkthrough of what's in the bill.
Wonderful. Ms. Parra.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, committee members. Christina Parra from House Research, and I'll be walking you through the DE2 that's before you. Article 1 is the general education article. Section 1 allows an educational agency or institution to share personal student contact information and directory information for students in special education with the Department of Employment and Economic Development to coordinate services to students with disabilities. Section 2 requires the district to make reasonable efforts to accommodate a student who wishes to be excused for a curricular activity for an American Indian cultural practice, observance, or ceremony. Section 3 requires districts and charter schools to adopt a policy on students' possession and use of cell phones in schools by March 15, 2025, and requires the principals' associations to make best practices available to schools on strategies to minimize the impact of cell phones on student behavior, mental health, and academic attainment. Sections 3 and 4 are for the Online Instruction Act, and Section 4 adds a reference to federal law, while Section 5 adds back language that was dropped when the language was recodified last year. Section 6 requires the commissioner to establish clear criteria for evaluating a district's application to use a 4-day school week plan, accept applications for a 4-day week plan at least annually, and determine whether an application meets the criteria. And then once the plan is approved, that would remain in effect for at least 6 years. Section 7 substitutes references to desegregation plans with references to achievement and integration plans, adds a cross-reference to a statutory definition of acquisition in the chapter on municipal debt, and modifies review and comment requirements for construction projects. Section 8 is a revisor instruction to remove the term state approved in several sections. Article 2 is the education excellence article. Section 1 strikes language relating to the SHAPE standards, which are used for physical education. Sections 2 and 3 relate to the language seals that students can obtain. Section 2 modifies the description of proficiency required for a proficiency certificate, and Section 3 modifies the description of how proficiency is measured to qualify for a seal. It allows a student to obtain a seal for showing proficiency in an Indigenous American Indian language. It strikes the requirement that a student demonstrate mastery of English language proficiency to obtain a seal, and requires the commissioner to establish guidelines on interpreting scores or ratings from approved assessments. Section 4 delays the requirement that students complete a civics course in grade 11 or 12 by 1 year and modifies the credit requirement for physical education. Sections 5, 6, and 7 relate to the world's best workforce. Section 5 adds a definition of on track for graduation. Section 6 adds performance measures for the 2025 to 2026 school year and later in the plan to include participation in honors or gifted and talented programming and students on track for graduation, and requires districts to report on participation and performance on advanced placement, international baccalaureate, and dual enrollment programs. It also requires reporting on performance measures for student subgroups. Section 7 requires the plan to include a language access plan to provide effective language assistance starting in the 2025-2026 school year. Sections 8 to 13 relate to statewide assessments, and this is last year the legislature recodified the statutes on state assessments, so these make changes based on that recodification. Section 8 changes a cross-reference based on, the recodification. Section 9 strikes language on accommodations that appears in another section. Section 9 prohibits retaliation against an employee who discloses information to the commissioner about service disruptions, and that's language that is currently in a separate section. Section 11 strikes language that is in other sections or is obsolete and adds language from other sections relating to general requirements for tests and test design. Section 12 also strikes language that's in other sections and also strikes the requirement that commissioner report data comparing performance results among school sites, districts, Minnesota and other states, and Minnesota and other nations. Strikes the requirement that the commissioner determine the testing process and aggregate data at the site and district level. Section 13 also strikes a requirement relating to how the student data is aggregated and disaggregated. Section 14 modifies the deadline for the department to post school performance reports on the department website. Section 15 relates to student journalism. It defines specific terms. It states that a student journalist has a right to exercise freedom of speech and freedom of the press in student-sponsored media. Prohibits the school district from disciplining a student journalist for exercising those rights, and protects a student media advisor for supporting a student journalist exercising free speech rights. It also lists conduct that is not protected and requires districts and charter schools to adopt and post a student journalist policy. Section 16 to 23 modify the Post-Secondary Enrollment Options Act, or PSEO. Section 16 adds facilitating career preparation to the list of purposes of PSEO. Section 17 requires a post-secondary institution to notify a pupil's school as soon as practicable if the student withdraws or has been absent for 10 consecutive days and not receiving instruction at home, in a hospital, or another facility. Section 18 modifies the deadline for the student to inform a district of the intent to enroll in PSEO. Section 19 eliminates limits on how a post-secondary institution may recruit or solicit a secondary pupil and eliminates some obsolete language. Section 20 requires secondary schools and post-secondary institutions that enroll students in concurrent enrollment courses to report certain information to the commissioner. Section 21 requires the advisory board of a post-secondary institution offering courses taught by a secondary teacher to include secondary and post-secondary students, if practical. Section 22 limits activities or opportunities that a student can't be barred from for participating in PSEO. Section 23 requires a district to adopt the same weighted grade point average policy for credits earned via PSEO as for concurrent enrollment. Section 24 modifies the deadline for providing notice to the parents of an English learner that the student is enrolled in an instructional program for English learners. Section 25 requires a district to provide English learners language development instruction designed to effectively increase the language proficiency of English learners, and that addresses Minnesota's English language development standards and rules. Section 26 repeals provisions relating to assessments, again, related to that recodification. Article 3 is the teacher's article. Section 1 modifies the requirements for a Tier 1 license in special education. And I'm just going to note that it's rewritten a little bit from what was heard in committee. Items 2 and 3, so on page 32, starting at line 16, it's the district or charter school affirms that the applicant will receive the professional development required there. And on line 19, that the district or charter school affirms that the applicant will participate in the supervision program. And then the limitation of 3 years is a separate paragraph starting on line 23. Section 2 clarifies the exemption for Tier 1 teachers to hold a bachelor's degree. Section 3 is the special education license for Tier 2 teachers, making similar changes as for Tier 1, with the district or charter school affirming that the applicant will receive the professional development and supervision required. Section 4 modifies the requirements for using the portfolio process to obtain a Tier 3 license. Section 4 expands eligibility for a Tier 4 license to include a teacher who obtained a Tier 3 through portfolio or holds a national board certification. Section 6 allows a teacher who obtained national board certification to obtain a Tier 3 or 4 license without taking pedagogy or content exams. Section 7 strikes the skills exam from a provision requiring testing accommodations. Section 8 prohibits a district or charter school from placing a teacher in a teaching assignment if the teacher has been charged criminally with certain offenses. Sections 9 or 10 are the same. One is for districts in the first class, the other for other districts, and it's requiring the teacher evaluation rubric to be based on the standards of effective practice that are in rule. That change would be in effect starting July 1, 2025. Sections 11 and 12 relate to the heritage and language culture teachers section. Section 11 modifies the definition of heritage, language, and culture teacher to require the teacher to be proficient in the language and engaged in the culture, and includes certain American Sign Language teachers as the heritage, language, and culture teachers. Section 12 requires the program to support heritage, language, and culture teachers to prioritize the participation of teachers whose own heritage language is one of the top languages spoken by Minnesota students, and for which there are fewer teacher prep programs for that licensure area or fewer teachers that hold a license in that area. Section 13 allows, this is for the mentorship grant that's administered by Pelsby, and it allows a tribal contract school or group of schools, a coalition of districts, teachers, and teacher education institutions to apply for a mentorship grant. And Section 14 repeals the Alternative Teacher Preparation Provider Report and the remedial a provision on remedial assistance for the skills examination. That is going on to Article 4, Special Education, has two sections. The first one allows the district to conduct an assessment for developmental adapted physical education as a standalone evaluation without doing the comprehensive evaluation. But allows the parent to request a comprehensive evaluation of the student. And Section 2 establishes a special education licensure reciprocity working group. Article 5 is the charter school article. The Section 1 modifies the statement declaring the purpose of charter schools. It requires a charter school to identify the purposes it will address in the charter contract and document the implementation of those purposes in the annual report. Adds implementation of the purposes to the authorizer's performance review of the school. Section 2 modifies three definitions, those of charter management organizations, educational management organizations, and immediate family. Section 3 strikes reference to a charter school plan under the world's best workforce and requires charter schools to comply with certain statutes on student discipline. Section 4 modifies the duties of the authorizer. It requires an authorizer to ensure the schools that are authorized have autonomy, fulfill the purposes of the charter school, and are accountable under the terms of the charter contract. It also adds responsibilities relating to approving or denying applications and oversight and evaluation of the school's performance and other duties. It also requires the authorizer to document staff's completion of training requirements. Section 5 clarifies that the process applies to an organization rather than an authorizer when they're applying to be authorizers. Section 6 modifies the duties of the commissioner related to the review of the authorizer's performance. It prohibits the commissioner from penalizing an authorizer for not chartering additional schools or for the absence of complaints against an authorizer. Section 7 strikes the requirement that a charter school include a statement of assurances of legal compliance. Section 8 strikes the requirement that the authorizer's affidavit state how the authorizer intends to oversee the performance of the charter school in compliance with the terms of the charter. It requires grades and number of primary enrollment sites to be reviewed under a separate subdivision, which is the next one, adding grades or sites, and that modifies the requirements for charter schools to add grades or enrollment sites and reorganizes some of the existing requirements. Section 10 is the Board of Directors statute and makes a number of changes to each subdivision. So the first one is it requires the initial Board of Directors and school developers to comply with training requirements upon incorporating the school. Subdivision 2 modifies the requirements for transitioning to the ongoing board. Subdivision 3 modifies the board membership criteria, in particular for the teacher on the board, and prohibits an administrator or supervisor from serving on the board, and also prohibits a person from serving on more than one charter school board at a time. Subdivision 4 modifies the requirement for changing the board's governing structure, so it would require majority vote in favor of the change by the school's teachers. Subdivision 5 requires the board to establish and publish election policies and procedures and provide eligible voters information about candidates at least 10 calendar days before the election. Subdivision 6 requires the board to adopt a nepotism policy. It states what the requirements of the policy would be. Subdivision 7 modifies the training requirements, and Subdivision 8 requires meeting minutes to be posted within 30 days of the board approval or the next regularly scheduled meeting. Section 11 requires the school to disclose to the commissioner any potential contract, lease, or purchase of service from a board member, employee, contractor, volunteer, or agent of an authorizer. Section 12 requires hearing on an authorizer's decision to not renew or terminate the contract. That has to be recorded by audio or video or court reporter, and the authorizer would have to preserve that recording for 3 years and make it available to the public. Section 13 limits mutual non-renewal process to only charter schools that are already serving enrolled students, so it wouldn't apply before the charter school opened. Section 14 requires a staff member to be employed for at least 480 hours in the school calendar year to qualify for the enrollment process preference that's available to staff members' children. Expands the prohibition on providing incentives to parents to enroll students, and modifies the list of conditions for determining when a student formally withdraws from a charter school. Section 15 prohibits a charter school from contracting with a CMO or EMO to provide necessary teachers unless it's a cooperative. Section 16 requires charter schools to establish qualifications for persons that hold administrative, academic supervision, or instructional leadership positions. It has a certain minimum qualifications, prohibits an administrator from serving as a paid administrator or consult with another charter school unless the board approves it, and prohibits the charter school administrator from serving on another charter school board. Section 17 prohibits a charter school employee or board member from serving on the board of the school's authorizer, and requires an employee or school board member to disclose any paid compensation received from an authorizer. Section 18 relates to the charter school audit reports, and it strikes the requirement that a charter school comply with statutes governing contracting. That appears in a new section, in the last section of the article. Section 19 requires charter schools to disseminate particular information about the school's offering and enrollment procedures to families that reflect the diversity of Minnesota's population and targeted groups. In Section 20, this is where that information, that those requirements about investing in municipal contracting are added, and that requires a charter school to adopt a procurement policy before expending state funds. There are requirements for what that policy has to include, including a threshold for employee purchases. And allows the commissioner to reduce a charter school's state aid in an amount equal to a purchase that's not in conformity with the procurement policy, or if there is no procurement policy, and requires a charter school to comply with statutes governing government property and financial investments and municipal contracting. Article 6, Nutrition and Libraries, has two sections. The first modifies the eligibility to become a sponsor for the Federal Child and Adult Care Food Program or the Federal Summer Food Service Program. And Section 2 allows the Metropolitan Library Service Agency to employ an executive director who does not hold a master's degree in library and science. Article 7 is health and safety. Section 1 relates to mental health education. Currently, there's an encouragement that districts and charter schools provide mental health instruction for students in grades 4 to 12. And this section changes that encouragement to a requirement starting in the 26-27 school year. Section 2, starting October 1, 2024, requires a district or charter school, to the extent space is available, to provide secondary school students with access to space to receive mental health care through telehealth. It requires secondary schools to develop a plan with procedures to receive requests for access to the space, and it must provide student privacy to receive mental health care. Sections 3 and 4 relate to the administration of drugs and medicine in schools. Section 3 modifies the exceptions to the requirements for the administration of drugs and medicine by including licensed nurses as personnel that may determine that drugs or medicine should be given without delay. Section 4 modifies the list of persons a district must consult with regarding the administration of drugs and medicine. Section 5 allows registered nurses and licensed practical nurses to administer epinephrine auto-injectors in a school setting according to a condition-specific protocol. And Section 6 clarifies the age range of students with regards to whom the department investigates maltreatment investigations. Article 8 is the state agencies article. Section 1 moves the Pelsby report on increasing teachers of color and American Indian teachers from the odd-numbered years to the even-numbered years after the first report is submitted by November 3, 2025. Section 2 modifies the deadline for a department to submit a report on rigorous course-taking. The 2025 report would be required to include data from the 22-23 and 23-24 school years. Section 3 strikes requirements from the health services specialist position at the Department of Education. Section 4 modifies the deadline for Pelsby's teacher supply and demand report and modifies data that must be included in the report. Section 5 authorizes Pelsby to collect non-licensed staff data on behalf of the department and requires the department to manage the data. Sections 6, 7, and 8 relate to the Interstate Compact on Educational Opportunity for Military Children. So they move those responsibilities out of the P20 partnership and into a standalone Military Interstate Children's Compact State Council. Then Section 8 states the provisions of that compact apply to minor dependent children of members of the active and activated reserve components of the uniformed services. And Mr. Chair and Committee, that's the DE2.
Thank you, Ms. Barra, for the walkthrough. We'll now move to member questions for clarification. Just a quick note that our full member discussion will be held during our hearing tomorrow following public testimony. Any clarification questions? Representative Bennett.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I do have a clarification question. Wondering if, with the changes in testing in parts of this bill, specifically on page 20, I believe, is there anything that would stop MDE from posting the results, you know, on the report cards that schools get, allowing schools and districts, you know, to post those so the public can see and compare schools and districts. Anything that would impair MDE from posting this information in the testing changes?
Ms. Parra.
Mr. Chair, Representative Bennett, the deadline is moved, so MDE wouldn't have to post the information until later, I think December. Currently, the deadline is September. But I think the department could probably better speak to these provisions.
Mr. Chair, if I could
please
point out the line. So starting at about line 20.19, somewhere in there, correct? Yeah. That area.
Ms. Parra.
Mr. Chair, Representative Bennett, I believe the commissioner could still report that. I'm not aware of of there being data comparing school sites, for example, to other nations. On the report card, some comparison to districts and statewide data is available. But again, I believe the department could probably speak to that better.
Representative Bennett.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. If the department could speak to that, that would be great. You know, if somebody's here that would have that answer now, or they can. Perfect. Or if you get it to me later, if you don't have that now, sorry.
Ms. Ariola, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Representative Bennett. Just so I'm clear, we're talking about the changes in Article 2, Section 2, beginning on line 20.9, the stricken language, is that correct? What I understand about these sections is these are meant to be strictly rearranging cleaning up statute. So that stricken language, I do believe, should appear at another point in these sections, but I would need a moment to find exactly where that lives. These provisions around updating and streamlining Section 120B.3 were meant to be purely technical and have no implementation impact. Oh, Megan Adiola from the Department of Education. Sorry, I keep forgetting to identify myself.
Thank you. Any other clarification questions? Seeing none, I motion to lay over House File 3782, and we will get the gavel back.
I'll just, closing comment at this point. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Please.
Just as we get to this point, I appreciate the members' patience as we walk through this bill. Also, it's at another point where we should reflect how much and how many people contribute to this bill. That right now, my name is on it as an author, but there is a composite of work that was done for this, and even putting together is a composite of work. So thank you for all the folks, and particularly our nonpartisan staff that did an incredible amount of work, and has always doing an incredible amount of work in very short time frames and, you know, beyond normal working days. And we are so deeply grateful for the quality of people that choose to do this work and stay with this work as we do what we're trying to do for the students in Minnesota. So both our nonpartisan staff, thank you very much for what you have done. Thank you also for the staff that has worked for me, my partisan staff, and the work that you have done. And of course, thank you for all of the bill authors for what is in the bill or will be in the bill before we're through, and the work that you did bringing this forward. And we do look forward to the comments that we'll hear tomorrow from the members of the public, and we'll take those comments seriously. This is still a work in process, and we'll look forward to the discussion and the feedback that we'll be getting.
Thank you, Chair Pryor. Again, motion to lay over House File 3782. And we will pass the gavel back to Chair Pryor. Up next, we'll hear from Representative Bennett on House File 4451. Thank you.
right. Thank you, Representative Bennett. So we have before us House File 4451. Representative Bennett, would you please move your bill before us for consideration?
So moved, Madam Chair.
Thank you. All right. I don't believe there's any testimony. So if you, Representative Bennett, if you could please introduce your bill.
Thanks, Madam Chair. And this bill requires MDE to establish a process for schools to seek a designation of a Purple Star school. And I will get into what that is. But before I do, I'd like to point out a couple things. One is, I believe in your packets, you have an article that was posted on Session Daily. And I just wanted to point that out because the two young ladies who testified in the Veterans and Military Committee, which I also serve on that committee, and they were not able to be here today due to their school schedule, but they did an absolutely wonderful job. So I wanted to just provide that article so you could read what they had to say as well. They weren't able to be here today. Excuse me. And the other thing is, we did have the fiscal note became available yesterday. It's a very small amount, something like $5,000, and MDE has agreed that they can absorb these costs. It's not a major issue in that area as well. So just pointing those out ahead of time. So why do we need a Purple Star school designation? First of all, I want to point out, this program is already in about 40 states in our nation, and it's working well. So I'd love to see Minnesota become one of those states. It is an optional program that school districts could seek. The reason for it is our military children face a lot of very unique issues. Things like moving from school to school, the average move for our military family children in their K through 12 experience is moving from 6 to 9 schools. And as the girls pointed out who testified in the other committee, oftentimes it's in the middle of the school year, and many times from state to state. There's a lot of disruption there with gaps and overlaps in curriculum, different graduating requirements, course placement disruption, and not to mention just the social and emotional issues that go with that, and with a move like that where your family is uprooted. So having supports in place for these kids is incredibly important. And those moves don't always take place if you have an active, say, a military member being deployed. It happens even to our National Guard families. And in addition, oftentimes when that parent is gone for 4 to 6 months, however long their deployment is, not only are they an absent parent, sometimes the families, say, move in with the grandparents, and so a move takes place there. So this Purple Star school designation would be, if a school would like to become a military family friendly school, they would meet certain criteria. I won't list all of them because you've got them before you in the bill, but it would be, for example, choosing a staff person serving as a military connection whose duties would be things like identifying military connected students in the school, serving as a point of contact between the school and those students and families, other things, making sure there's information on the school website in regards to different types of programs or other things that military families could find helpful, offering transition help for those students, and basically just giving a lot of the support that those young people need to be successful in their school career. As I mentioned, these are not necessarily for schools that are right by military bases. It could be anywhere in our state. We all have, and every school has a military family in their school, whether National Guard or other. So I love this program because it not only comes alongside our military families and those students and helps them become successful, but it's also an option for schools who want to raise to that level and be awarded this designation. I pretty much, Madam Chair, I guess I'm going to leave this short and sweet and just open it up for any questions that people might have.
Representative Keeler.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you, Representative Bennett. I think this is a really cool program. I've been a military generational kid, and so I do understand the moving. I know when we talk in transitions, I talk a lot about it in the homelessness world. When an individual moves, even one time, it can set them back educationally 6 months approximately. So if they're moving 6 to 9 times in a 12-year time span, that can deeply impact them. The one question I have is, because I'm a border city and our National Guard sits in Fargo, which is obviously another state, would my school district be eligible to apply even though the National Guard unit is out of state? Does it have to be in state, or what would that look like in a community like mine?
Representative Bennett.
Thanks, Madam Chair. Very good question. As it would be, any school in Minnesota can apply, so your school is obviously in Minnesota, and yes, they can apply for that designation. A school doesn't even have to have a military family to be able to apply. They just need to meet these requirements so they are ready for a military family. So if somebody from the National Guard, a family living in that state, goes to your school, they can get that same help.
Mm-hmm. Super interesting. Thank you.
Yes. Thank you. Thank you for the question. Well, thank you, Representative Bennett, for bringing this bill over forward. We are laying it over today, but members, you might expect to see this still move forward as part of a general policy bill. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
All right, and so with that, House File 4451 is laid over for further consideration and possible inclusion in the education policy bill. All right, and Representative Hicks, you are up next. We have House File 4159. And this is our final bill up for consideration this day. And it's our intention to hear this bill and leave it over for possible for further consideration. Vice Chair Hill, would you please motion House File 4519 before the committee?
So moved.
Thank you. All right. Representative Hicks, please introduce your bill.
Yes. Thank you so much, committee and chair, for hearing this bill. I feel like I've been in front of you a lot this session, talking about disability needs in our schools. And a lot of times when we're having those conversations, we're having that from a conversation of IEPs and legal requirements to support. We haven't really talked about the importance of understanding that disability is part of the human condition, and that the disability community has its own culture and its own history, and that ableism is rooted in a lot of the discrepancies that we see. It's part of what is influencing segregation. It's part of what is impacting our very, very significant discrepancies. And so today I come with a bill to encourage and to create and embed ableism training in our school preparation for our teachers and our educators. We can't solve a problem if we don't label it, name it, and start talking about it. And so I am so grateful that you are all willing to hear this bill today. And I'm more grateful that we have an amazing group of folks coming to share a little bit more about why this is important for the disability community.
Great. So with that, we'll turn to our testifiers. And I have Jillian Nelson up first, Autism Society of Minnesota, and after that on deck would be Elena Bates. So, Jillian Nelson, would you please identify yourself and begin?
Good afternoon, Chair Pryor and committee members. I am Jillian Nelson, Community Resource and Policy Advocate for the Autism Society of Minnesota. I'm also an autistic adult, a former special education student, and a co-parent to an amazing autistic 9-year-old. I want to ask for your support for House File 4159 for a very simple reason. Ableism is the biggest impairment that people with disabilities face, and it's a decade-old problem. 25 years ago, my special ed team prepared me for careers such as cashier or customer service because I was disabled. They assumed I would never succeed in a more challenging role. They never suggested I go to college or I take the SATs. 15 years later, both my brother and sister, who also have disabilities, dropped out of high school because of ableist comments and blatant disrespect from their teachers. And just last week, over dinner with my partner's kiddo. He told me how it makes him sad that many of his teachers don't understand autism like he does, that they want him to try to be like the other kids. This is ableism, the devaluation of a person based on their real or perceived disability. This is what our students are experiencing at every single grade level for generations. Ableism and disability justice training are cultural competency training for the disability community with the goal of reducing trauma incurred through education. Although the current cultural competency standard references disability, it does not include any mention of ableism, of disability justice, and does not require that persons with disabilities be involved in the training in any way. This provision does not increase the training hours required, and as such, it shouldn't increase training cost. It simply mandates that teachers direct 2 of the already required hours of training to ableism and disability justice. There isn't a single other culture that we would allow to be taught in large groups with zero cultural competency training. There isn't any other culture that we would accept cultural training about without input from the culture we are teaching about. This is why this bill matters. Thank you for your support, and thank you for your time today.
Thank you. Next up, I have Milena Bates, and after that, Brittany Hernandez-Wilson. When you're settled in and ready, you can identify yourself again and begin.
I'm Milena Bates. Thank you, Chair Pryor and committee. And I just wanted to start with thanking you for what you do, which makes Minnesota one of the better places to live for the disabled community. It's known across the country that it is one of the better places. I'm here to speak about 4159, and because of my unique perspective as a parent, disability support provider, volunteer, as well as someone with my own disabilities, I can see the importance of this from many angles. I'm also a co-founder of a nonprofit called Minnesota Autistic Alliance, which provides community education, individual and family support, and fosters leadership by disabled people. Ableism is not just discrimination or prejudice against individuals with disabilities. On the more deeper level, as defined by Talila Lewis, it is a system that places value on people's bodies and minds based on societally constructed ideas of normality, intelligence, excellence, desirability, and productivity. It's not something we can just reject and uninstall from our minds like software. We have been introduced to it starting with childhood stories where disability was a curse or a punishment. Think about a few fairy tales. It's a part of social norms, and it's usually not even questioned. One of the best examples of unintentional ableism that I've encountered by well-meaning teachers would be suggesting educational goals like increasing eye contact, which only serve to make an autistic student appear slightly less autistic while actively hurting their ability to learn. I strongly believe that this training would have a significant effect on the quality of education and achievement gaps for our community, and that is why I ask you to support it, and I can tell you there's a lot of hope and excitement in our community about this. Thank you.
Thank you. So, Brittany Hernandez-Wilson, and after that, Ryan Hines.
Good afternoon, Chair Pryor and members of the committee. My name is Brittany Hernandez-Wilson, and I am the Equity and Justice Director for the ARC Minnesota. I am also a proud disabled person who was born with a rare joint and muscle condition. Due to my condition, I use an electric wheelchair to move around in the world. Growing up in the special education system was an isolating experience. I had no language to use to describe the experiences that I was having. More specifically, the ableism I was encountering on a daily basis, how I was constantly othered by my teachers and my aides, how my abilities were presumed based on the diagnoses that I was given. It was very hard growing up not seeing teachers and aides that looked like me. Reflecting on this time in my life brings back a lot of pain and difficult moments that I couldn't really unpack as a child. Now, as an adult, I know that ableism was what I was experiencing. Ableism being a system that places value on people's bodies and minds based on societally constructed ideas of normal. These ideas decide who is valued in our world. And as a kid, I didn't know ableism as a word. But believe me, I always understood that I was seen as less than, as different, and that my needs weren't labeled as human, but that my needs were special. This frame of view was very detrimental to my sense of self and self-worth. I struggled throughout my life, and especially as a child, to understand why my desire to be included with all of the other kids, to have access to the classroom and be treated like everyone else, was considered a special need. I just wanted to be treated like all of my friends who weren't given this label. I often wonder who I would be, how I would develop as a child, if my teachers would have known the ableism that they were carrying out. Would I have loved myself sooner? Would I have had the sinking feeling that something was wrong with me? What could I have achieved if my teachers understood the impact of their words or even the difference between the medical and social model of disability? The truth is that I will never know, but I am here to give this testimony to help the future, to make sure that children with disabilities in school have teachers who understand ableism and its implications. For when we have the knowledge, we can make better choices. We can choose to show up in an anti-ableist way. When we challenge the ableism that is so ingrained in our education system and in our world, we can show up in a way that truly empowers all students, including disabled ones, to be their best selves, to imagine what's possible, and to believe that they are worthy. Because no child should ever feel like they are wrong, just for existing. As an adult, I've spent decades unpacking and unlearning the negative beliefs about who I am and my worth. I have come to find pride in my disability, and I am still, to this day, working to be a person who is self-confident, who feels worthy of life for the same way that people who are not given these labels have and feel. Having teachers learn about ableism and disability justice is truly the bare minimum. If House File 4159 passes, it would help support teachers to not only understand and unpack ableism, but also provide them with strategies on how to promote anti-ableism in education. And since ableism is rooted in all other forms of oppression, I believe that it will be very beneficial for understanding how to promote inclusivity for all students and staff. Lastly, the course must be taught by people who have disabilities, for we know how ableism works best. Thank you.
All right. Ready for our next testifier? Ryan? Legal Advocate, Minnesota Disability Law Center, and then after that, Jenna Strain-Lutz would be up on deck.
Thank you, Madam Chair and committee members. My name is Ryan Hainsey, and I'm speaking to you as a legal advocate at the Minnesota Disability Law Center. I'm also speaking to you as a former special educator for nearly 6 years, as a student who grew up in the special education system, and finally, I'm speaking to you as a proud autistic adult in support of HF 4159. Ableism is one of the greatest challenges faced by people with disabilities. The discussion about ableism is incredibly rich and important to the disability community. Educators will benefit greatly from an understanding of ableism and disability justice. As an autistic special educator, I repeatedly witnessed a need for understanding of my autistic students and other students with disabilities. I observed implicit biases by teachers and administrators who had negative preconceived notions of the capabilities of my students. I felt that my students' strengths and gifts that they brought to the classroom daily were overlooked, or they were seen as something special or unique compared to their non-disabled peers with those same skills. Student strengths were viewed as a miracle, rather than something they were born with or as a skill that they developed intrinsically over time. This was never a malicious act. I love teachers. I was a teacher myself. I had so many great teachers and administrators. But this is just one example of how ableism shows up in our educational system. As a student, I was quietly ashamed of being in special education and did everything I could to show that I was a helper in the special education classrooms rather than to admit I was in fact a student in those classrooms. This is a historical, but unfortunately, still a current example of how ableism shows up in our educational system. Educators working with students with disabilities are under a tremendous amount of stress and are spread far too thin. The community of adults with disabilities is an incredible resource that should be involved in the education of students with disabilities. No other marginalized group is similarly excluded from the discussion about how to educate members of their own community. We would think it absurd to have a conversation about how to educate any other group without involving members of that group, but yet, this is the norm for students with disabilities. I am here with a deep and lifelong experience with the special education system to ask you to support HF4159. I thank you for the opportunity to testify.
Thank you. Thank you for your testimony. Next up, we have Jenna Strain Lutz, and after that, Daniela Indovino Colley. Please introduce yourself.
Thank you, Chair Pryor and committee members. My name is Jenna Strain Lutz, and I am speaking to you as an early childhood special education teacher from Minneapolis Public Schools in support of HF4159. As an early childhood special education teacher, I work with parents of infants and toddlers who are discovering that their beautiful young child has or may have a disability. There are a lot of unknowns, but often they are thinking about the potential and likely stigma and bias their child will face in school and in their community. It weighs heavy on them. Ableism is a significant burden for people with disabilities, and yet it is least often addressed in social justice conversations, especially in our schools. As a teacher, I have had extensive pre-service education and ongoing professional development on race and gender. But even as a special education teacher, I have had minimal education on ableism and the history of disability justice. I am also a mother of three young children, and ableism has not been part of their public education thus far, even though they are having incredible conversations and learning about other areas of social justice. With 17 to 18% of Minnesota students receiving special education, these conversations are needed for educators and in our classrooms. It is imperative that educators have an understanding of ableism and disability justice. I've personally learned so much from adults with disabilities, and my practice as a teacher has dramatically changed. I also see that impact with the parents that I work with and how we see their child. We are now presuming competence and establishing appropriate supports for their child to access education rather than just trying to fix their child. It is important to center those with disabilities in these conversations and learning, as no other marginalized group is similarly excluded from these discussions about how to educate members of their own community. We have gone far too long educating our children without the voice of disabled individuals. This bill would support me as a teacher and provide a more welcoming experience for children with disabilities and their family, along with their peers without disabilities. I am here to ask your support for HF4159, and I thank you for the opportunity to testify today.
Thank you. All right. And our last testifier is Rachel Biggs, if you can be ready to go. All right, please settle in and identify yourself.
Hi, I'm Danielle Indovino Colley. My name was wrong on the roster, so I just want to correct that. And then, hi, thank you. To Chair Pryor and the committee, I forgot to say that I'm the Vice Chair of the Early Learning Advisory in Bloomington Public Schools, as well as a member of the Special Education Advisory Committee there. And I'm a disabled mother of two disabled children, in Bloomington. My guiding principle in life is inclusion by design, not by accommodation. And I think HF4159 does this in establishing an instruction requirement in ableism and disability justice that's distinct from other teacher training and education that focus on specific disabilities and individual accommodations. Hearing from a person with a disability how the world and invariably classrooms, because they're part of our world, can be oblivious to the way kids with disabilities are devalued, can begin a really meaningful process of change in our schools that teachers can drive and create through the pedagogy that they then bring into those classrooms. Just to clarify, this is not a mandate on schools. This is a licensure change. I know that, want to make sure that's really clear. And I just want to talk about how I am ADHD, and when I was young in the 90s, things were really different, and I struggled a lot. And one day in fourth grade, I was fidgeting inside my desk, and my teacher dumped my desk out on the floor and made me sit next to my pile of my things all day. And the message there was very, very clear. It was that I was the problem, and I should be publicly shamed for it. And I expelled a lot of energy then to not be the problem for the rest of my schooling career. And it caused depression and anxiety, and I later was bipolar, and I don't know if I would have been anyway. Like, genetics say maybe, but it was really hard to get through those years and into college. And, you know, my teacher didn't have access to this education, didn't even have access to that girls could get ADHD. Like, we know that. But I worry about my daughter because she's also hiding who she is and struggling. Her teachers are amazing and affirming and working really, really hard. And I want to be able to give them just 2 hours to imagine a school and a world that's inclusive by design and not by accommodation. And for that reason, I think that this would really be helpful for everyone in our community. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you for your testimony. All right, and our final testifier is Rachel Bix.
Thank you, Chair Pryor and committee members, for giving me time. My name is Rachel Biggs, and I'm a retired elementary teacher from Bloomington. I taught for 24 years and was a witness and participant in the tremendous progress that has been made in how we meet the needs of all students. I retired in the prime of my career due to an illness that has resulted in permanent disability. Nothing can prepare a person for that life-defining diagnosis, but I'm hoping to turn my experience into helpful information which may assist you in seeing the value of this bill. One example of progress that I experienced and participated in includes the integration of many special education services now being provided in the general education setting when appropriate. General education teachers are providing service without fully understanding the intricacies of a student's disability or the forms that ableism can take. I personally have always valued learning and knowing as much as I can about my students, which allowed me to reach and teach them the best that I was able. And I did a good job. But my perspective has definitely changed. And I now realize that I unknowingly participated, certainly not purposefully, but simply from a lack of awareness in ableism. The teachers that I have encountered in my career really believe in the adage of when we know better, we do better. This bill is not intended to become another add-on to a teacher's already full, not plate, but platter, but an integral and currently lacking facet of professional development for both new and veteran teachers. If I had known what I know now about living with a disability, I would have done better. And I want that opportunity for all teachers in Minnesota. Not only do teachers have students with both visible and invisible disabilities, they have students whose adults at home have disabilities as well. Knowledge is power, and I believe that Minnesota teachers will turn this new knowledge into change and growth. In order to serve our families better, 2 hours of training over a licensing period is a very small ask. It is simply an acknowledgement of another facet of diversity and the spirit of empathy that our public schools embrace. I would like to reinforce that this training for teachers should be taught or provided by a disabled adult who has experienced public schools and life with a disabled body or a disabled mind. We want all of our students and families to be seen, heard, and valued for all that they bring to our classrooms. Thank you.
All right, we will turn to member discussion and Representative Burke.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm in a mic desert here for some reason. Thank you. Thank you to the author for bringing this. The last testifier actually spoke on what I wanted to say, is that we do have students where the disability is not immediately visible. And going back to the woman who spoke, saying learning how to love yourself with this, oftentimes people who have difficulties with people with a disability, oftentimes it comes at the person with the disability, and sometimes it comes from deep inside the person who has the disability. And, you know, as a parent, we don't always know how to deal with the different emotions that come from it. And mostly what I hear from teachers is that they do this because they love it, because they care about the children, because they want to make a difference. My teachers did. And so I think looking at this as less of a thing that's forced upon them, but as a thing that will help them relate to all their students, which is why they go into the profession, because we all know it's not for the money. So I really very much appreciate this. It does make even the family members of kiddos that struggle feel really seen. And I'm, you know, a little sad that it's taken this long, you know, for you to come in here and advocate fiercely for this. So just thank you.
Representative Keeler.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you, Representative Hicks. I've said it before. I really appreciate that you show up in spaces and advocate for community. The maybe's been invisible in spaces. I know what that feels like, especially in the education system. I fought really hard to have the history of Minnesota from an indigenous lens. So keep up the fight. I do have a question, and I'm not sure if it's you. It's more around the higher education pathway to become a teacher. I know that there's an intersection at sometimes, you know, that we bring special education in to overlap with general education preparation for teachers. Are teachers getting this education or awareness if they're going to school in Minnesota to become a teacher? Do we know that, at least, that like our graduates are being educated or have conversations around this?
I'll look in the audience to see if there's anybody who's more recent, but I can tell you it's been a few years. But usually there's a class on exceptionality, but it doesn't talk about ableism. It's really about special ed, and how you know, it's really more in that vein. Ableism and disability culture and disability justice really isn't seen in the same light in social justice as other groups, and that is partially because we're a little bit earlier in our journey, right? It was the 80s before we moved people in state hospitals out into community, right? Like we're a little bit earlier in our journey. And so I think this is the beginning of some of those conversations, and really naming it, calling it ableism, calling it disability justice, talking about it as a culture and as a component of humanity.
Thank you.
I think that's great. I think that when we add some of these requirements into the relicensing program, it does kind of signal to higher education that maybe we should be doing this in our teacher prep stuff. So continue that work. Advocates, continue the work in that higher education space as well. I think it's a great bill. Thank you.
All right. Closing comments, Representative Hicks.
I just want to thank the committee for hearing this bill and from hearing from all the amazing testifiers. We don't change our world, and we don't move to full inclusion without acknowledging every different piece of inclusion. And we won't get to full inclusion in the disability space with just special ed teachers holding that torch. We need the whole community to be with us and having those conversations with us from a lens of understanding. So I'm grateful that we heard this bill today, and I'm looking forward to it being included.
Thank you, Representative Hicks. All right, and with that, Vice Chair Hill renews his motion to lay over House Bill 4159 for further consideration. All right, so we're leaving early today. Tomorrow we'll hear testimony, and we look forward to that. And then that's when I think we can have a substantive discussion on the bill, knowing that Wednesday afternoon we'll have better weather than Thursday night. And that is actually my concern. So we've talked about the viability of a good discussion on Wednesday, and I think that we should be in good shape for substantive discussion on Wednesday. But on Thursday evening, we are scheduled for amendments and final passage of the bill. I can pause if there's any questions or issues for this schedule as we go through this final week of this committee. So hearing no more discussions, with that, we are adjourned.